Welcome. We've been going through this summer the Psalms of Ascent. These are songs for the road, your playlist for your summer vacation that you have on your iPod or whatever. My guess is that none of these are on there. That's okay. These are songs that help us understand what it looks like to journey towards the presence of God. So we come tonight to Psalm 128, and we'll have one more psalm next week to conclude our series. I don't know if any of you who specialized in 1980s VHS movies could remember this, but The Neverending Story, do you remember this movie? Yeah, we got a couple hands out there, a couple head nods. It was a story within a story, right? And ultimately the story within the story was about a little boy named Atreyu, I think, right? Atreyu. It's been a while. Good. Okay, nobody... Harrison's nodding. Yeah. Uh-oh, somebody is out there checking. It's been like 20 years. But I do remember this one scene. Atreyu, for some reason, on his epic quest, his coming-of-age quest in this fantasy world of the never-ending story, has to go find a giant turtle in a rock swamp or something like this. A giant turtle. Would you recognize a giant turtle if you saw one? You know, do you think you would? Would you be able to tell the difference between a turtle and a tortoise? Maybe some of you out there would. I know that one's for you. Could you recognize a giant turtle? That's the sort of question that Atreyu is faced with as he journeys into this misty, swamp-like area. The only solid ground are these huge, rocky hills. And if he gets off of those, he's into the muck and in the mud of the swamp. And he looks for what seems like days to catch a sight of these fabled giant turtles. And what does he imagine he's going to see? You know, I mean, a giant turtle, maybe that big. How big is it really? You know, would you recognize a giant turtle? Well, ultimately, after much searching, Atreyu is at a loss. Where will I find the giant turtles in the swampy, misty rock swamp? And he's about to give up. He's about to go home and be defeated in his quest when the earth shakes underneath him. It shakes again. He's really regretting this whole swampy rock swamp thing. And then he looks down and realizes he's been walking on a turtle the whole time. Would you recognize a giant turtle? It was somehow like bigger than he had ever imagined. And yet it was just the ordinary ground under his feet, this giant turtle. And I wonder in some ways if in this metaphor we haven't been doing this sort of thing with God. That God is the giant turtle here, and that we, in looking for him, look for something pretty big, something pretty spectacular, maybe a turtle this high that would have blown our minds and gotten tons of likes on Instagram if you took a picture of it when you were in the Galapagos or whatever, right? And you couldn't find one. And you got burned out because the spectacularly giant turtle that you thought you were going to find is nowhere to be seen. You know what I'm talking about, right? This search for God's presence in this really sort of spectacular way, right? We look for God's presence in churchly ways. When we come to church, we want big crowds. We want lights and sounds. We want a giant old organ. I remember one time this search for God's presence took me to Williams-Brice Football Stadium at the University of South Carolina. The Pope was going to be there. It actually didn't take me. It took my dad because it happened in 1986 and I wasn't born yet. But the Pope was coming to Williams-Brice, and they were going to pack it out. This is God's representative on earth, according to the Catholic Church. And the Pope said this. He said it to the assembled 85,000 people who had come there to see some spectacular sign of God's presence. He said, "It is great to be young." He said, "It is great to be young and to be a student." And everybody's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "It's great to be young and to be a student at the University of South Carolina." And everybody went, "Wah!" And they went crazy, right? The Pope was a rock star at all those Gamecocks out there. And then you know what they did, right? They went home from this spectacular religious manifestation of God's presence. And they went right back to doing what they were doing before. Thoroughly unchanged. And the only relic of the Pope's visit this spectacular churchly presence of God type thing. It's a little monument on the horseshoe now that has that quote from 1986 on it. And everybody walks by and nobody even looks at it. See, we look for God's presence in this big sort of religious experience, and ultimately, He wasn't there. Maybe you look for God's presence in other ways. Maybe you don't. If you're here, my guess is that this is not your go-to, right? You didn't come to Christ the King looking for the rock concert, I hope. Sorry if you did. Not sorry. Actually, maybe you look for God's presence in a different way. Maybe you look for signs in the sky, right? Some sort of sign, spectacular, supernatural sign that God is with you, that He would communicate with you in some extra special, extraordinary way, right? You know the language? Well, I'm just waiting for an open door so that I can know what to do. I'm waiting for a sign in the sky from God. I'm waiting for Him to do something spectacular. This looks really faithful, but is it? Has God communicated with us in this way? We look for it in other ways, God's presence in spectacular ways. Extraordinary stories about villages being converted to the gospel, magnificent healings and miraculous things occurring in our lives, pilgrimages undergone, spectacular adrenaline and extraordinary. That's where we look for them. And we walk through life not getting many of those things. Maybe sometimes we do. I don't want to discount all of that. But not very often, right? And we start to feel like maybe this trudge, this search for God's presence through the Psalms of Ascent was a big waste of time because there are no giant tortoises here. And then all of a sudden, there's an earthquake. And the ground we had been walking on, that ordinary ground, well, God was there. I think that's what the psalm wants us to recognize. How would we know when we enter the presence of God? Would we see something spectacular? I mean, put yourself in the mindset of pilgrims traveling from their tiny little villages up to Jerusalem to worship. This is a special event. It's like Super Bowl Sunday or whatever in their culture. Happens once or maybe twice a year. Big party, whole village locks the door and starts walking up there. It's extraordinary, right? It's spectacular. And the psalmist, recognizing the temptation of human beings to think that God only shows up in huge ways, gives them this song to sing on the road. This sort of clue as to show them where the scene of God's presence, where does He show up? Well, verses 2 and 3 make it really clear where God shows up. First, when God shows up, He shows up by giving us meaningful work. I can't think of anything more mundane than the thing that you do from 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 or whatever, Monday to Friday. But when God shows up, when you enter into His presence, something happens. And it's not that extraordinary. In what it is actually, just the basic old ground, the basic mundane, God gives us meaningful work. Verse 2, you shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands. It's sort of an anachronistic metaphor, right? You don't really think about in your work eating the food that you grow. You're not a farmer. We don't live in an agrarian society, right? But if you think about it, it actually sort of makes sense. That if you put a seed into the ground and you water it patiently and you wait over the course of seasons for this thing to grow, ultimately what comes out of that thing, out of your labor, is the thing that keeps you alive. There's this connection between what you're doing and your life, your sustenance. And it feels deeply meaningful to you. And I think that's what God is promising us here through this psalm, that it becomes yours. You do it, and you do it because it fits into a story, the story of God making all things new again. All of a sudden, the work that you have, though it seems insignificant, stands for something deeply meaningful. Why you do it becomes clear. My least favorite household chore growing up was raking. I hated it. Because every Saturday morning there would be new leaves there, and I had to do it over and over and again. And I'm pretty sure my dad assigned it to me because it was the thing that he hated the most as well, right? But then I got my own house, you know? I realized that this was mine. This was my ground. That was my yard that the neighbors were going to look at and pass judgment on and cluck their teeth at when I moved into the neighborhood. And you know what I started doing all of a sudden a little bit more joyfully? I started raking. You know? Let's get the grass sorted out because it was mine, right? It had a sense of meaning and purpose to it. And this psalmist says this, that as God's people, your work, your Monday to Saturday, has meaning. It adds to God's kingdom and it helps keep you alive. It's what you're for, this sort of work. God gives us a why for our work. It's because you're His and He puts you here to do it, and it's a good thing. That's not the only place he shows up in sort of meaningful work. He also shows up in this like domestic scene. Verse 3, your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Behold, thus shall a man be blessed who fears the Lord. Okay, listen, disclaimer, right? Total male gaze in the author, right? They're writing this to the people who could read at the time, which were men. But that doesn't mean that this is exclusively a blessing for men. Instead, what we have is this vision of a household that is harmonious and beautiful because of God's presence showing up there. Can we sort of imagine a house where the wife is fun and fruitful and contributes, where the man raises up his children kindly and cares for them and wants to cultivate a sense of duty and virtue and goodness in them as if they were olive shoots? Wouldn't that be a sort of beautiful thing for us? Don't we want that kind of thing? We all love a home that functioned like a party. That's the metaphor used here, right? The fruitful vine. You know, it comes from a fruitful vine is wine. Olive shoots, this sort of this thing that the rich would eat, this delicacy in that time frame. This is the metaphor for the family that lives where God shows up. Here's the point. Do you go to these places looking for evidence of God's presence? Is that where you go? Do you look for His presence in some duty that you have at work? Or in the harmony of your family? Here's what I think. God shows up usually, not in extraordinary ways, but actually in deeply ordinary ways. And the more we look for giant tortoises, the more we miss the ground under your feet. I think you get this already. We got an example in our own city where this sort of ordinary thing is actually more spectacular and beautiful than the extraordinary thing. In the 1970s, Elbert Square was a square just like every other square in the city. But they tore Elbert Square down for the spectacular. You know what they put there? The Civic Center, right? The Civic Center. Now, in every other square, it's made up of specific things on specific blocks. They have what's called the tithing and the trust blocks. And on a trust block in a square, you know what you would have? You would have things like schools, churches, public meeting spaces, right? And then on the tithing squares of the block, you would actually have houses, you know? And what do people come to Savannah to see? Do they come to Savannah to see the Civic Center that we erected in 1970 to be spectacular? No, that thing is an eyesore, right? What do they come to see? They come to see the spaces where ordinary life, ordinary work, ordinary worship has been practiced for centuries, right? People are tourists here on our ordinary, you know, the ordinary thing. That God has actually showed up there over centuries and blessed it and made it beautiful. So much so that you know what they're getting ready to do at the Civic Center, right? They're going to tear it down. And you know what they're going to put there? A square with tithing and trust blocks. Right? Ordinary, ordinary, ordinary stuff. God shows up over the long haul in the simple life of work and home. That's what He does. Y'all know, some of you may remember Larissa, who is a participant in our group for a while. She's doing the Camino pilgrimage trail in Spain. And I asked her if I could sort of share something that she shared with me. She said, you know, as I've done this sort of pilgrimage hike, which entails hundreds of miles over many days that religious pilgrims used to take in Spain. One thing I realized is that actually most of it is not very amazing. What's most amazing about it is walking on this well-trod path that has been worn smooth by the feet of pilgrims doing the same boring thing that I'm doing, right? Walking. You can't get any more ordinary than walking. Just something that we all do every day. And yet somehow that ordinary thing, repeated over and over again, has become a vehicle and a means for God's blessing and His presence to show up. We pine for big and we want spectacular because we think that's how God shows up. But most of the time, He shows up in ordinary life. Ordinary life as the scene of God's presence. What happens when He shows up? What happens when God shows up in our ordinary, boring life? I want to argue this, that ultimately the thing that this psalm says happens over and over again is that God blesses us in those spheres. Is that really what you want? We think that we want blessing, but I wonder if some of us don't think that more when God shows up, we have a different sort of emotional experience. We feel convicted. We feel guilty. We feel ashamed. We come into the presence of a God who is constantly demanding more of us, right? And listen, it really is true that when a holy God comes into the presence of a sinful people, we're going to feel guilty, right? There's a part of it. But for many of us, I'm afraid that God looks a lot more like Matthew Morrison. This story came out of News of the Weird recently. This is a 44-year-old drifter who knocked on a door and asked the homeowner if he could camp out in the front yard. And the homeowner, because they are a kind, caring person, I guess, said, yes, camp out in the front yard. Well, Matthew Morrison thought it would be a good idea as a prank to sneak into the house at night and set up firecrackers under the homeowner's nine-year-old daughter's bed or whatever, and light them off. Needless to say, the homeowner did not think the prank was very funny, but everybody was shocked and running around screaming, right? And I think most of us want God to be something like that. Like when He shows up, it's like, oh my God, I want to walk out of here feeling so terrible about myself, right? Or I want to walk out of here having felt deeply terrible, but then heard the good news that God loves me and He forgives me. And that's the sum total of my religious experience. And what I want to argue is that this psalm holds the fear of God and the blessing of God tightly together. Verse 1, blessed is everyone who fears this holy Lord. But over and over again, it comes back to this. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord. Verse 1. Verse 2, you shall be blessed and it will be well with you. Verse 4, blessed, behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you from Zion. Peace be upon Israel. Do you see the sort of balance in perspective here? That God says that when He shows up in ordinary ways, He shows up to bless you. To bless you. Yeah, you're going to have to fear Him. We'll talk about that. But look at the proportion, this sort of ocean of blessing being poured out upon the people who have come into God's presence. Now, I want to throw a disclaimer out there. Much of the blessing here is in the future tense, right? You see, you shall be blessed and it shall be well with you. This is not some rose-colored glasses look at our ordinary life, right? Much of human life is hard and there's plenty of suffering in the Gospels. But this is how we know that God is showing up and that He is coming near, that sometimes He gives us this foretaste of what it will be like fully and finally when the King returns. Blessing. It's like Emma and I at our resort for our last vacation. We always sort of knew room service had been there because the bed had been made and all the sand that we had tracked in from the beach had been swept up and all the bottles in the minibar refilled, right? And it was just like, and a little mint on the thing and that night's room service menu, which we ordered frequently, and the sheets turned down in that way that you could not replicate at your house. I don't care how much Marie Kondo you've watched, you know, like, room service had been there. And there was so much care and concern taken for us that on some level it was like we spent most of the trip feeling guilty. It took like 3 days of feeling this amazing service and blessing to kind of get over the experience of like, I owe somebody something here. I owe them something here. We knew that the presence of room service had come because of the way that we were blessed. And that's the same thing with God, that when He comes into our ordinary lives, He pours out not cursing, but blessing. Well, do we owe somebody something for all this? You know, I guess that's the question. If the scene of God's presence is ordinary life, if the scent of God's presence is the scent of blessing, there's also this sort of siren of God's presence that like calls us into response. I've got a neighbor who's not from a part of the country where they have those tornado sirens. And one day, I was not a cloud in the sky, probably 12 noon, you know, blue skies and everything else. And the tornado siren in Parkside went off. I got this frantic text in all caps. I was like, what do we do? You know, like, I don't know what to do. And I walked out and looked up at the sky and said, it's okay. Lowercase, deep breath, you know. This is the siren that sort of calls us into action. I think that's how God's blessing in our ordinary life works. It sort of gets us up and says, we got to do something in response to it. What do we do? Well, I'll say this. Our love for big, spectacular comes out again. What do we do in response to God's blessing? Let's vote. Let's start a movement. Let's have impact. Let's impeach the president. Let's support the president. Let's build the wall or tear down the wall or raise taxes or lower taxes. You know, like those are kind of our response. These meta-level society-wide responses. But this text calls us into something smaller and more difficult. Smaller and more difficult. It says, blessed is everyone who fears the Lord and who walks in His ways. See, the psalm calls us into obedience in our own lives. It doesn't preclude big movements, okay? But I'm saying, like, can we all just sort of admit that we like to run there first instead of cleaning out our own house? We get all the info and our massive intellects and all the news at our fingertips, and somehow we just like blot out the responsibility to like love our neighbor and love our kids and like not lie, cheat, or steal, or commit adultery. You know, like the really simple, easy things that are actually really hard things. We're like the astronauts on the moon landing, and this was probably more relevant a couple weeks ago. They came up on the anniversary of the moon landing. A lot of these stories came out about the initial astronauts. James Irwin was one of them, one of the Christians who went to the moon. And he said that he was struck when he got up on the moon, because here he was at the sort of figurehead of this civilization, this society. The astronauts were selected because they were the smartest, most capable men at the time. They had the biggest intellects. They had all the resources of an entire culture. We're going to put them on the moon to defeat the Soviets. We got a lot invested in this. These guys are the best of the best. And James Irwin said that when he finally got to the moon, he stood on the surface of it and he looked at the earth. He got so far away and he put it up and he covered up the earth, which had every human being on it, with his thumb. And it just disappeared. And he attributes part of that experience to his conversion, because he felt in that moment so small and alone. You could blot out the world with all of your experience, knowledge, information. You could forget the mundane workaday lives happening on five continents back there. And you know, mostly the story of the astronauts is a story of men who forgot that. These guys who had the best brains and the most resources our culture had to offer were actually racked almost universally with despair, doubt, and depression when they returned from the moon. They had gotten so high that when they came back to Earth, they couldn't live functional lives. They'd become the most like God, but the least like men. In fact, in a study of the 30 astronauts who walked on the moon, all of them had families. You had to fit the stereotype of the American dream, be an astronaut who's going to defeat communism by landing on the moon. Out of 30 families of these guys, 7 remain intact today. 7. Our best and brightest. You know, stood on the moon high above the tip of a movement But they forgot to like keep calm and go to parish group, I guess. Or show up at church. Or eat meals with their neighbors. Love one another as they would want to be loved. Have we forgotten that? You know? Have we made the Christian life about the movement and less about obedience? Here's the reality that when we become most like God, we become least like men. But when God becomes most like God, He becomes most like a man. You know? That the movement of God is from the throne room of heaven, the throne room of Zion and Jerusalem, out into the ordinary, the small, the mundane. That's where He shows up. That's where Jesus shows up. That's where He's doing work. Sure, He governs history, but more than that, and can I ask this, does He govern you? The story of Christianity, the story of the gospel, is God becoming flesh and Jesus and moving into a neighborhood. And this little particular point, I held, Ty and Nicole had their baby recently, Lillian. And it always kind of hits home for me with other people. It didn't really with mine because I was just in shock when I held my kids the first time, I guess, or something. But with other people, it's this weird thing. Every time I hold one now in a hospital or something, I'm like, God, like this feels, yeah, it's inconceivable to me. And yet, that's the story. A God who comes into a point because He loves it and wants to bless it. And who calls us to fear Him in the little things. I'll close with this. There's a dog in my neighborhood that everybody hates. It's a holdover from a different era of Parkside when dogs were allowed to run around their front yard unchained and unfettered. It lives under the truck of a house about four doors down from me. And I really kind of enjoy, because I know this dog is there, watching the interactions of people who do not know that this dog is there. Because this dog is not that big. He's probably right there. And he doesn't look mean initially. And because he's not on a fence, a lot of people want to pull up and try to rescue him, not realizing that they're on his turf. In fact, last week I saw an older woman pull up and do a U-turn around the block to go rescue this dog. She gets out and I'm just watching because I know what's coming. She goes, "Here, doggy, 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 doggy," trying to lure him out of the truck. And here's what happens every time. Every single time this dog goes, "Ah!" And this older woman throws up her hands and goes running back to the car. You know, and everybody in Parkside hates this dog because it's just so freaking mean. Okay, it's a mean dog. And if anybody has a right to hate this dog, it's Jason. Jason walks over to check on his mom across the street probably three times a day. And Jason is always getting attacked by this dog. And one day I saw Jason coming down the street and the dog underneath the truck. And I was just waiting and watching to see how it was going to happen. When something weird happened, you know, Jason stopped and got down under the truck and threw something under. I was like, "Jason, what are you doing? Take your hand back. You're going to be bit." He's like, "No, I'm feeding him, man." And I just thought, he's feeding this dog? I was like, "Jason, everybody hates this dog." And he's like, "Maybe that's because nobody feeds it." And I was like, "Jason, that's amazing." What I was thinking in my little Christian monologue, what grace, what mercy in small things to take the moment to stop and give the dog a biscuit. And Jason punctured all that with his unique brand of folksy humor when he said, with all the adult words still intact, it's like, "Yeah, every time I walk by here, I think, here's a freaking biscuit, you mean butt dog." You know, like, he's just doing it out of like stubbornness. He's being like kind to this thing. And I wonder if like, if a non-Christian like Jason, and I know that for other reasons, can love in small ways a mean butt dog, can we? You know? Then, can we do the easier and harder work of loving Jason? You know? Recognizing that the substance of God's relationship to us is us underneath the truck, barking at everybody that comes by, and a hand getting down and giving the mean butt dog a biscuit. That's Christianity. That's the grace of the gospel. Can we, as God's people, live it out as we pray together? Our Heavenly Father, we long for this psalm to come true in our own lives. We long for the blessing of your presence to show up in ordinary ways. And that longing is informed by some of the ways in which it hasn't shown up. And we long to fear you, and we're trying. And we lament the ways that it hasn't, and we look forward to the day in which it does. When the little hints in our ordinary lives of your blessing become fully fledged kingdom pronouncements, we look forward to your presence fully and finally with us. We look forward to the resurrection of the dead and the life which is to come. Will you give us strength to obey in small ways now? In ordinary ways, which are sometimes the most difficult ways. Will you open our eyes to the needs of our family and our neighbors and our city? Will you give us hearts that care about those things? Would you show up in our community at Christ the King in a new way? Would you bless us, God? Would you? We pray this together, praying the prayer which you taught us, saying, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. For yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.